Good day, big boys and girls, parents and grandparents, and everyone interested in AI and robotics. I am Anastasia, and I'm bringing to your attention AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie, a podcast for AI muggles, not wizards. Together with my guests, I translate AI and robotic technologies from difficult to easy to understand. Can AI write books and poetry? Do we confuse prompting with critical thinking and putting our thoughts on a piece of paper? Are large language models great companions or tools leading to destruction of cognitive skills, or maybe both? And I am deeply honored to welcome Naomi Susan Barron, who graciously agreed to be my guest today. She's a linguist, and her career spanned several decades. Today, she is a professor emerita at American University in Washington, D.C. She acquired her PhD at the University of Stanford. And Professor Barron's interests are quite diverse. She writes about writing and reading, the relationship between speech and writing, and the history and structure of the English language. And before we dive into AI, I would like to ask her, Naomi, first of all, welcome. How come that you ended up writing about AI?
First, thank you very much for having me on your show. I've been interested in artificial intelligence actually for many, many years. Back in the 1970s, I went to a conference in New York, and there were all these people speaking that I'd never heard of, but they were all talking about this thing called artificial intelligence. And I realized something was going to be happening in the way that we thought about machines and our relationship to them, and the way that we thought about what thinking is. Because if maybe machines could think, and that was an idea suggested back in the 1950s by a man named Alan Turing, then what did this mean about human thinking? We weren't thinking at that point that that AI would be able to do writing in the ways that it can today. But one of the people at the conference was a man named Isaac Asimov. Isaac Asimov was a chemist by training, but most people know of him as a science fiction writer. And he was really interested in the question of, well, what does the technology now, so that was the 1970s, what does it suggest maybe we could do with machines or against machines if they got better than we were?
This is so fascinating. So the whole history of AI is actually at your plate. If we set up a scene, as a linguist, could you define what is AI in writing and what is AI in literature? Probably those are not the same.
Okay. AI in writing means today, because different periods of time have different models of how artificial intelligence is done. But today, as you mentioned in your introduction, there are these things called large language models. And they work by taking some very sophisticated formulae, you know, technically algorithms, and then they have this huge bunch of writing. They have other things too. They have pictures and they have computer code, but we'll focus on the writing. And it's called a data set. It's just a huge amount of stuff that other people have written that has been scooped up from what's available on the internet. And based on what you ask AI to write for you, so you say, write me a 12-line poem about the trees in a fjord, which is this beautiful sort of inland waterway in Norway. And then it writes a 6-line poem for you. Okay, how does it do that? By looking, and that's in quotation marks, by looking at all the other stuff, all the other people whose data are in there have written, and then it predicts what's likely to be the next word that would show up in that poem. Okay. Now, it's the same technology regardless of what you ask it to write. You ask it to write a 500-word essay on climate change. You know, you've been given this assignment and you don't really know what to write. You say, you know, you put in this what's called a prompt and you say, write me a 500-word essay on climate change. You could just as well say, write me a 500-word short story and make it really spooky, make it really seem as if the ghosts are coming out. You could say, make it very elegant. You could say, write it in very simple language that a four-year-old would understand if you read it aloud. Or you can say, write that same story for an adult. So what is the borderline between writing when AI is doing it and writing literature when AI is doing it? It's the same technology at work. The results may be very different. And how good the literature is, and we can talk about that, is an issue. But it's exactly the same mechanism at work, regardless of what you want it to produce.
This is really fascinating. When I talk about LLMs to students, I usually say, look, this technology has nothing to do with language. And people are very surprised because large language models, but it's this statistical stream of tokens. And token might be even smaller than one English word. It's like, I think, two-thirds of a typical English word, and we can dive into that. I must make a confession. This morning, I wanted to do an experiment with LLM, and I asked it to produce a language because, you know, I absolutely love Tolkien, right? And he developed languages for his writing. So not just the Lord of the Ring, but everything around it. So I think he started developing the Elvish language when he was a child in school. And that was the foundation for all his stories. So what ChatGPT gave me did not delight me very much, I must admit. So probably there was not enough Elvish to dive into and to regurgitate as a stream of those tokens. But I think those experiments are quite interesting because they are on the borderline of a question. How do we create? What did we create in the past and what might happen in the future? And I'm deeply aware that some writers start using AI in their books. So I consulted AI pronunciation tool today because the name is Japanese, Rie Kuden. And she was awarded quite a fabulous prize for Sympathy Tower Tokyo. I ordered the book. I haven't read it yet, but I am full of expectation. So she used ChatGPT for approximately 5% of this book. And this novel, it's set up in a near future Tokyo where AI is ubiquitous. So I kind of see where she might use AI to talk about this new world. Are you aware about other examples of authors using AI in their literature?
There are examples of people who are so-called indie authors, people who independently publish their books rather than going through a standard commercial publisher. And I've read stories or accounts of their experiences where if they're writing an awful lot of books, say you want to publish something every 6 or 8 weeks because that's how you make your income. And you publish it on Amazon and that's all good, but you have to keep writing all the time. There are a lot of tools that were out before ChatGPT came out. So ChatGPT came out on November 30th, 2022. But there was another tool before that called PseudoWrite. That's S-U-D-O, Write, W-R-I-T-E. And it was a tool built on GPT-3, produced by OpenAI, the same as ChatGPT, which is really GPT 3.5. But this is a tool that you could use a little bit for free, and then you paid a little bit per month to use it regularly. And if you're having to do a lot of writing of literature, but it's not literary literature, it's more popular literature, you have to keep the machine fed, you have to keep going. And this particular writer, Jennifer Lepp, relates how first she would use PseudoWrite to create, you know, some descriptions, you know, sort of filler text, as it were. And then gradually she came to rely upon it more and more because it was pretty good at writing in her style, and it was very fast. And at one point she realized that what she was reading was not what she had written.
Yeah.
Now, how many people use it for things like a description? Let's say you've never been to one of these fjords in Norway. So there's a beautiful fjord called Sognefjord, and you've seen some pictures of it, but you haven't been there yourself. But there are lots of people who have written about it, and that material is in this data set. And if you ask for a description of the fjord at sunset, it will give you a description that you probably couldn't have written yourself because you haven't been there at sunset. How many people are using this? I don't think you will find the writers who win prizes, you know, who win a Booker Prize or win a National Book Award in the United States and so forth, or a Pulitzer Prize in the United States. I don't think you'll find those people using AI, except maybe to track down some information that they then put into their own, I won't just say their own words, I'll put into their own being, and they write the way that they would write. And it's the same kind of thing you do if you read a travel book or you saw a National Geographic special on the fjords of Norway. It's getting information and then making it your own. So that's my guess. In the scientific world, in the research world, it's very, very different from what's happening in literature. And we can talk about that. But the thing about literature is if you're writing because it's not just there's something you want to say, but there's a way you want to say it, you don't want some other tool telling you how to say things.
So we're actually on something tremendously important. Why do people write? And I think the response to this question were right in the course of history. So if we take the 18th century theater in Europe, so plagiarism was the taste du jour, because people just shamelessly borrowed from each other, but there was no such a concept as copyright. So, for example, there was this, I think it was Austrian, Kotzebue, who just produced hundreds and hundreds of theater plays, and Netflix did not exist. So people went to, I don't know, to the place in the village and watched something displayed in front of them. And then this Kotzebue was translated in multiple languages with some local colors. For example, a Serbian translation, they just added quite rude words to everything what Kotzebue was writing, because apparently that was the language on the streets, I don't know, in Vojvodina or in Croatia or whatever. So plagiarism was completely all right, and then it was no longer Kotzebue, but someone else on the title of the printed copy. But this changed. And today, I'm aware, people are teaching authors to discover their inner voice. What is it?
What's the inner voice? All right. So the whole bundle of questions in there. Your first question is, why do people write and how has that changed historically? A second question has to do with copyright, or why did people plagiarize and what counted as plagiarism, and then what's happening today. So let me try to take those in turn. Historically, as best we can tell, writing evolved for the first time. It, by the way, writing evolved many different times in many different parts of the world. Okay, so it's not as if we think human speech only evolved once. We can't prove it, but we think so. We know for a fact writing evolved many times. Probably it developed in the Mesopotamia area, where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers are, around 4000 BC, as best we can tell. The earliest uses of writing were basically for identifying property. You know, your seal, I own this. Then for administrative purposes. So in really old so-called Mycenaean Greece, you know, let's call it at least 1500, 2000 BC, there were administrative uses of keeping records of how many bushels of wheat did you have and so forth. There were laws that were inscribed in public places. Not everybody could read them, but they were laws, Beth. And literature came later. The notion of writing about lived experience, they weren't writing a lot of science fiction, came later. And then, as we know, newspapers didn't really develop until the end of the 16th and then the beginning of the 17th century. The novel didn't evolve until the 18th century and then really flourished in the 19th. And then there were letters and there were diaries and essays and all kinds of other things. But these came gradually. So why were things written? There were different political reasons. There were social reasons. There were religious reasons. And the notion of why an individual chose to write is really a literary question. And for that, you needed to have the evolution of poetry, which is old in different societies, and the notion of a diary. As letters are actually quite old. Some of them date back 4,000 years ago, and you can find them on clay tablets, you know, where you're sending a letter to your son who is off somewhere. So what's really clear is there are many, many reasons that people have written. The copyright issue is an interesting one because we talk today about plagiarism, and a plagiary is a theft. But the notion of what counted as appropriate borrowing or making use of, as opposed to stealing, is a very modern notion, comparatively speaking. Shakespeare took a lot of his plots from Holinshed's Chronicles. It wasn't thief. It wasn't theft. It wasn't thievery. It was, those were stories that were going around. But what he did with them made them uniquely Shakespeare. And it wasn't, at least in England, until the beginning of the 18th century with what was called the Statute of Anne, she was queen at the time, that you had any kind of law that said, you can't just take the work that some author did and put your name on it. And there have been battles that have gone on, not just in England, but throughout the world, in terms of what kinds of laws there are and whether people follow the laws. I'll just jump way ahead right now to say there's a huge number of lawsuits going on, particularly in the United States now, where authors are saying, OpenAI or Google or Meta took my literary works, or took the New York Times, took the newspaper content and fed it into this large language model, and they're now part of the data set. But that's copyrighted material. They had no right to it. It's against the law. So the copyright and the plagiarism issues, because in principle, if something is produced from that large language model that looks very much like what one of these people who's suing OpenAI now, if it looks like something that person wrote, if it's in that person's style, because you can replicate styles pretty easily now, then is that theft? And it becomes a very complicated legal issue.
And there are some advices of different associations saying, if you want to train your own large language model or small language model on your style and on your writing, then be our guest and go ahead. but don't touch someone else's work. So right. I'm quite curious how this journey will go, if at all. So I won't be seduced to train any model on my own writing because I simply enjoy writing. But this is a very different story, right? So who knows, maybe a lawyer would train the model to do legal briefs, or a doctor would train a model to do, I don't know, description of therapy, but not writers. What is your opinion? Where is this journey heading?
Okay, so two ideas come to mind. The first is, if there's a specific knowledge area, so let's take medicine, let's take infectious diseases. If you were, if you're an infectious disease doctor and you really want to be able to work as efficiently and effectively as you can, you'd love to have a data set and a large language model that's trained on it, that knows everything that's out there in all the journals and the books about infectious diseases. So you can get a notion of, well, I don't know what this is. Let me see if I can figure out symptoms. And it used to be you'd have to read an awful lot all the time. That's now available. And many people in the sciences are creating probably smaller language models because you don't need a big one. You don't need to do everything. You just need to do, in this case, infectious diseases. So that is actually happening now. And it's happening in a way that I think is very productive. And just as you don't necessarily trust, even as, let's say, an infectious disease doctor, everything that you read, you may consult with another colleague, you at least get some ideas. Okay. So that, I think, is a wonderful use of feeding in as much information as you can into a language model of whatever size for a particular purpose. Then there's the other question you ask of, well, where is this going? Let's say that the works, and I'll think of American legal thriller writers. So you take someone like Scott Turow, okay, who writes lots and lots of legal thrillers. And he's one of the people suing OpenAI as part of a class action suit. Now, I've been reading a lot about what the copyright lawyers think is going to happen with these suits. And you have to understand something that will sound technical, but it isn't really. Copyright is not on ideas. Copyright is on specific language, the specific joining together of words, of how many words can you take from some author before it becomes plagiarism. Okay. But the way that large language models work, or this is the way that, say, OpenAI is arguing its case, and Meta and Google, and it's true, is when you build your data set, what you do first is take something, maybe you took off the internet, or you know, have a digital copy of a book, and you munch it into little pieces. You munch it into individual tokens, which, as you explained, yeah, are not, statistically, they're not even the size of a whole word. They're almost a word. I mean, sometimes they are a whole word. Sometimes they're a phrase. Sometimes they're just the ending of a word. And then you sort of mush that all around, I'm speaking metaphorically, and then what is generated is very unlikely, when you put in a prompt, it's very unlikely to be the same joining together, the same concatenation of words that were in the original document. So if copyright is on the expression of particular joined together words, then it's unlikely that anything that's generated will violate that interpretation of copyright. So if I were betting €5, if I were betting €5, I would bet that the authors and all the other people who are suing these companies are going to lose.
You know, I must join you in your bet. And there is one thing which is quite close to my heart, but it might be a controversial thought. I am not considering writers to be victims. I think they are hunters. They hunt for a reader. because this thrilling feeling that someone might love what you do and enter into a dialogue and maybe this exchange of opinions. This is something which is, I think, wonderful. But of course, if you make your living out of your writing process, this is tremendously difficult. And probably if you are a professor in chemistry and then you write thrillers, it's a better option. But I do not know. Borodin was a professor of chemistry and he wrote fabulous music.
Indeed. I'm glad he branched out.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you know, there is a thing here. I'm quite curious, and we are now in another domain. There are some mysteries in the history of literature, whether one writer really did what he did, or what we think he did, like Sholokhov. So there are tons of guesses whether Mikhail Sholokhov truly wrote The Peaceful Dawn, or I don't know how they translated into English, or whether he borrowed from some younger writers. And I wonder whether AI could help those scientists studying his work to understand whether it was him or someone else. Are you aware about examples where AI is getting used to kind of follow the historical path and recognize the authorship?
Yes. but if you don't mind, I'll shift to English and to Shakespeare.
Wonderful.
A number of years ago, so it wasn't the most recent language models that we have now. In fact, it wasn't language models. It was a different configuration of how you did AI. There was a question asked by some researchers, at least one of them was at the University of Texas at Austin. And the question was about one of Shakespeare's plays, because we know that Shakespeare, for some of his plays, collaborated with other writers. So it wasn't even a question of, I'm taking some histories from Hollingshead's Chronicles, but rather, I have a co-author, as it were, a co-playwright. And the question is there a way to figure out whether this language is Shakespeare or whether it is some, a lot, all of the co-author? So they ran all the plays of Shakespeare and of this other playwright who wrote independently through a version of AI, and came to a percentage decision. I don't remember exactly what the details were, but the principle was you can recognize the style of an author by looking at lots of that author's work and then taking, we'll call it an unknown. I mean, we know there's this play, but let's say we don't know who wrote it. Let's put it in to this, today it would be a large language model, and see if it comes out looking more or less like this author. Or you take act one, maybe that's going to be different from what's in act two, and you can parse it any way that you like. So indeed, that is being done. And I'm quite sure the same thing is being done when suddenly someone discovers what might be a new poem of, name your favorite author. And there are people who say, yes, it is. And then there are people who say, no, it's not. There's this kind of discussion going on now with a painting that was found that might be a Van Gogh.
Yeah.
Or might not be. And we have all these experts being paid to look at everything Van Gogh had done. But one of the ways that in principle one could perhaps help that process along is by looking with artificial intelligence at the work that he did, the work that others did, were things borrowed from other sources? Did anyone else have a hand? Well, Van Gogh, he did it or somebody else did. He probably didn't, you know, it was not like the Italian Renaissance where maybe the assistants would do the clothing and then the master would do the face. You know, Van Gogh probably did all this fun stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Indeed. Indeed. So I can absolutely see ways for writing, and probably for other things as well, of detecting with some reasonable degree of probability, there I hedge things, that something was done by a particular author. Now, to be fair, we say definitively, this was such and such an author, and then discover 50 years later, no, it couldn't have been. So if AI is wrong, humans are too sometimes.
Absolutely. And it brings me actually to a question. What about reading? And if we somehow went into this, why do people write? Why do people read? And how did this evolve in the course of, let's say, the last probably 25, 30 years?
Oh, that's a short span in terms of reading, but we can do it. Why do people read? The answer to that, of course, is at least as broad as why people write. But people significantly read for two reasons, to really oversimplify. Forget about reading for school because you have to, or reading for a job. One reason is to learn things that you haven't experience that you don't know yourself. So if I want to know about the Lebensander horses, okay, I didn't get to see them last time or the various times I was in Vienna, but I can read about them. Okay, so I can experience, even before there was video and television and whatever, I could read about them. And so much of what we know by reading, historically. Okay. A second reason people read is to experience other people's lives. I mean, the reason that the novel developed in essentially the 18th century, at the time it did, was a reflection of changes happening in society when people were becoming middle class and they were having life experiences that were different from what their parents and grandparents and great-great-grandparents and so forth had had. And how do you live in this world and who do you become? Today we read history. Why do military generals read history? Because they still do. You go to the U.S. Naval Academy and they are reading very old books because they want to understand how smart people who engaged in warfare thought about it. Why do we read novels today? Because we don't want to necessarily live the lie. Why do we read plays? We don't want to necessarily live the lives of all those people because some of them ended up in unhappy circumstances. Some of them were not good people. Some of them were not the kind of people we'd ever want to become. But to understand what the world is made up of and the world that you live in, reading has been an incredible tool for making that happen. And to cut to the chase on what might be your next question, to the extent we rely on artificial intelligence to read a play, to read a novel, and then summarize it and analyze it and compare and contrast. It can do all that really, really well. And every day it gets better and it becomes a little, go back to my word, spooky. But what happens to us when we're not going through the reading experience ourselves? Another reason that we read is it teaches us so much about language. Much of the vocabulary that we learn, we don't learn because we hear people in everyday conversations using it. We learn it because we read it. There was a phrase when I was growing up, it was active vocabulary versus passive vocabulary. Yeah. Active, the stuff that you would hear and you would speak, and passive is the stuff that you read and you could understand. Sometimes you'd have to look it up, but you'd see it in context, and it's the context of reading that makes you understand a lot of words. When in the United States, when we teach foreign languages, often we say, don't look up every word. I'm going to give you something to read that's harder than you can manage, but you can understand some of it, by the context. Okay. And that comes from reading. It doesn't come from memorizing vocabulary lists. Another thing that happens is you learn how other people write. So if you care about writing at all, and you don't have to be a literary writer, it could be a newspaper writer, it could be a legal writer, pick your favorite. You learn how people who write well in a particular genre do it by reading a lot of the things that they have written. And to the extent that we're not reading the originals, but relying on AI to make a munched up summary of it, then we don't have that experience. We haven't learned what it's like. It used to be that libraries would collect early drafts of famous writers' manuscripts. You know, writer would die and would will his or her library to and manuscripts to a library. And you could watch that person whose work you may have admired and loved. You could watch that person becoming the writer that he or she was because you saw the strikeouts and you saw the compared drafts. These days, when you're doing word processing, that's gone.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's gone.
I remember reading one interview, and I unfortunately forgot who said it, but the saying was, Leo Tolstoy summarized Anna Karenina in writing Anna Karenina. So that was his summary.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Absolutely. But I would like to understand, what do you think? There are a lot of claims that using AI in writing or in reading through those summaries on apps reduces cognitive capabilities of humans. Is it true?
All right. You've asked a question where we've had a smidge more than 2 years to seriously think about. And if you want to ask what changes in our cognitive capacity, it's going to be years before anybody can meaningfully ask that question. I think the best we can do, but we can do something, is to ask, if you were reading a summary of, I'll pick on Shakespeare again. If you're reading a summary of Hamlet, as opposed to struggling through Hamlet itself, even if you have some notes to go with it, well, if that summary was written, in the United States, there are all these kinds of summaries of literature. There was one called Cliff's Notes, another called Spark Notes, and there are various other versions. These predate AI in the way that anybody today knows about it. So there are versions of this. And we can do the experiment without needing AI to create the Spark Notes version of Hamlet, because we already have the Spark Notes version of Hamlet. So what all that you really need to do is to take a class of students. Maybe we'll do this as a summer experiment so you don't really compromise their regular academic year learning, and have them only read the summaries. Only read the Spark Notes version. You're not allowed to read the plays. So first you find out to do this experiment that they have not read these plays. And then you have another group of people who actually read the plays. And then you ask them, not even a comprehension test, it's an analysis test. It's what do you think? What did you learn from it? Did you identify with this character? Why? And I think you will find very easily differences in what you derive from the two different kinds of experiences.
And it's all about experience. It's all about experience.
Right. So one of the things that's true about a lot of literature and a lot of reading more generally, so it could be a scientific article that's hard to understand, particularly if you're not a specialist in that field, is it's hard work. What AI does for us is it simplifies the task. And sometimes that's fine. If you say, I want to see everything that's written about this particular infectious disease, I just want short summaries so I know what then I would go back and read myself in more detail. And there are all kinds of tools out there now for doing this. In fact, OpenAI just this past week, introduced a new tool called OpenAI Deep Research that can do what other tools that are out there can do, but probably in a much more sophisticated way. It's not released publicly unless you pay a lot each month to OpenAI for the sort of premium subscription, but it's going to be out there more and more, and there'll be other tools like that. There's nothing wrong with using those tools, just as there's nothing wrong with reading a science journalist who's writing for a general audience to read what what that journalist says about some new discovery. How did I learn about deep research? From reading on MIT Technology Review, a summary of what's going on. And then I went to OpenAI's site and I got some more detail. There's nothing wrong with the fairly easily understood by a general audience beginning. The question is that the ending? And we're going to increasingly make that the ending, and that's my concern.
Well, those are golden words. And frankly, who knows what is going to happen in 10 years from now, because we might even move from this LLM architecture to something else if we invest into very different capabilities and reasoning rather than, let's say, statistical processing of things.
Right, of course.
Naomi, thank you so much. That was a fascinating conversation. If I may, I would bring you on this podcast another time because we really scratched the surface. And that was another episode of AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie. And he is Romy, Robbie and the Secrets of Sleep, which is available on my website and Amazon. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening, and goodbye for now. And knowledge and AI literacy would lead us to a world where AI is beneficial for all of us. Thank you.